Welcome back, everyone, with GCC Tech Talks by 70 Experts, here with Si. They're kind of part of our summer series that we're doing. We've been on holiday and traveling, and we had Eid, so I hope everyone had a good time. Bringing a slightly different perspective today with Rafael Pere, who is a seasoned chief product officer and business leader. But yeah, how have you been, Si? Are you good?
Well, very well. I feel like I'm out of touch a little bit.
So do I. Yeah. I sort of feel my brain is a bit. I need to get back in a bit of a shakedown. So, but it's a good one to introduce to. So, Rafael, thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Welcome. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Brill. So, I guess where we tend to start is a little bit about who is Rafael. I know your background's in product, and you've worked for some big organisations that I'm sure we'll get into. And now you're in Dubai for the second time, because we had a brief conversation off air. But yeah, a little bit about yourself, you know, where you grew up, what you've been doing, and maybe your journey into being a product leader.
Sure, with pleasure. So I'm French, although the accent doesn't give that away. And the reason why I don't have that accent is I'm an expat kid, which is what brought me to Dubai 30 years ago, where I spent a little bit of my childhood. And my best childhood memories are camping in the desert.
Yeah,
and also one of the big drivers for why I wanted to come back.
So we may have crossed over. We may have crossed over and met each other at some point.
Maybe in some, you know,
because we were at 94, 93, 95. I was there at the same time. Maybe Wadi bashing or dune bashing, we may have bumped into each other.
Definitely. Well, it was a much smaller community.
It was a small world
back then, right, as well.
Yeah, such a small community. Everyone knew each other. I knew everyone from the other schools. Yeah. It's much more difficult now because it's grown into the metropolis that it is.
Yeah. And so then studied in France, being French, engineering. Decided to go into tech because I'd always been attracted to understanding how things work. And that's where the most interesting developments were happening. From the get-go, went into startups. I started my own company doing school photography online. Talk at length about all of the pains around that. Not an area I would go back into in France. And then after a few years of that, realizing that we'd hit a plateau, it's a relationship-driven business, I said, okay, what am I going to do next? And looked at jobs across the big tech guys and saw this job called product manager at Google. I was like, that ticks every single box of what I want to do. It's close to the technology, to the development, but without actually doing it, it's different every day. Mm-hmm. You need to take the bigger picture, consider the business side. And so that's how I got into product.
Just quick one on that. So did you have any hands-on product experience before Google? Or was Google sort of your first?
Not knowingly. So some of the things that I was doing was product, but I'd never put that label on it. I was CTO at my startup, so I was doing the tech. But of course, also having to think about some of these product problems without any kind of structure or vocabulary for it. And this was back in 2014. Product management wasn't as established as it is today.
Bit like project managing. Project managing was a similar kind of stage at that point as well. Product owners, I think, from what I remember, the very first product owners that I probably came across was about 2015-16, I think. Mm. 2015-16. Again, it was rare in data. It was probably more in software engineering rather than data. But yeah, and it used to be quite big organizations like Google, you know, like your banks, your insurance companies and stuff like that. I think that's when it kind of started to take off, shall we say. But I won't cover everything that you're going to cover. But yeah, that's the kind of era that I think product owners started to kind of become a title, a job title, a proper job title. I think Google might have been one of the first, actually. Google.
But what a place to start your career, kind of.
Yeah. I mean, I was... My dad told me, okay, you want to move on past your startup? I don't want you to just take anything. See what you want to do and try to get it. And so I went for Google, not realizing that I would get in. And got in, and then fascinating time, fascinating company. Some of the smartest and nicest people I've ever worked with. And then when you move on after that, you realize that the people that you were complaining about at Google, you would hire them in a blink of an eye. You know, the power of perspective. And so after 3 years there, working on a number of B2C, B2B, everything around Android enterprise, security, working with the Google's internal security team as well, which is fascinating, some of the best people in the world. And then I decided to move to Asia to see a different part of the world and move to Singapore.
Brilliant.
Back to the startup world, a number of different startups. And the last startup I left after 7 years. In January, I became independent. And until then, I led product and then marketing for a cloud security startup that went through, you know, MVP, raise, exit, integration into Bitdefender, a global cybersecurity company.
Familiar with Bitdefender.
Huge, huge range.
Yeah.
So from your perspective, just diving in, because you've got startup and obviously huge conglomerate enterprise with all the sort of cogs and the process in place. What's quite different from working at a startup in product? How does that compare to somewhere like a Google, where I assume everything was, you know, it's not all set in stone, but at least you've got some frameworks and some good people to go work with? Because I assume at startups, you're kind of building the team around you as you go, as well as, you know, probably a little bit more scrappy at a startup.
So the interesting thing was, when I went to Google, my thinking was, I'm going to go somewhere where I am going to learn from people that know how to do things properly. I'm going to learn the process. Because at a startup, you learn through failure. And that's tiring. And I went to Google and I realized that they just put smart, nice people in a room and said, figure it out. And that was it. The reality is, there is a lot to learn. It's just not formalized as strictly. So there are a lot of, let's say, tools, but they're not forced on you. You take what you want. So a lot of what I learned around product management was not explicitly taught as, this is the way that you need to do things. And I think that that distinction was actually really, really important, because what I see a lot in product management is people that are going through the motions without understanding why. So for example, the typical thing is, there's a slide deck for whatever, and people will take a template and fill it in, when maybe four slides make no sense. But they will still fill the slide in, spend the same amount of time as every other slide, including that one slide that should actually make up 80% of the whole meeting, because that's the real, you know, challenge, right? And that's, I think, the biggest thing that I learned there. Now, going back to your question about what's different, the biggest challenge with product management that I had personally in the startup world was that people didn't know what product management was. And I want to first establish a distinction, because there's product management and there's product owner. And there's scrum master. And there's all of these different words that were all very new at the same time and mean different things. And a lot of people didn't know any of them, particularly in emerging ecosystems like Singapore. I still consider, you know, the GCC ecosystem to be emerging. So they don't really understand it. And for something like product management, a lot of people imagine that they can just, well, I have an idea. Why do I need this middle layer thing? I'm just going to talk to a developer and they're going to build it. And
do you feel then that the best practices for product management it doesn't exist yet, or will it never exist?
At the beginning, the only way to get into product management is to do it. And so how do you do it when you haven't done it? And to get into it, you need to have done it. And now there are a lot of courses on it. And that's in some ways it's great, but also we get back to this idea of like, you're going to go through the motions without really understanding the reason for the tools, right? It's as important to know which tool to use as it is to know how to use a tool or know the existence of a tool. So I think it's better now, but with AI, we're getting to a whole new area because the cost of execution is going down so dramatically that we're going to come back to an area where you're going to have to figure out, what are you building? Like, why are you building it? Yes, you could build it all, but you shouldn't.
I think let's park the AI, because I think we're going to get into that a little bit more.
There's one other question that's burning for me to ask, is around, like, you were in France, then you went to Asia, then you're over here. Where do you feel that the GCC is? And what challenges do you feel that organizations will have in the next couple of years around this kind of dynamic where, like you have to manage the product to market, shall we say, and you have to make sure that you kind of still fit that kind of initial kind of remit that you were thinking of, shall we say, and how do you test it? Like, as in, like, I think what I want to get is the view, how you would test it in Singapore, how you would test it in France, and the difference of here, shall we say. And I think that's, like, as in, it's something that we've not brought up in any of our podcasts
so
far.
And it's an interesting paradigm, because there's a lot of tech companies now coming out of the Middle East.
Yeah.
You know, I know I've got a friend who works for, a unicorn, right? And it's, there's a lot more investment, there's a lot more eyes in the region, but do we have the skills and the people and the framework and the experience here? Which kind of ties into your question, is how does that differ across those different geos?
Yeah, I think it's more, I'm trying to drive at where you feel, like, as in where you feel the GCC is around product, and what, like, what you see the next 2 years being, and what things that certain people, like our viewers, could do in order to kind of progress it at a faster pace, should we say?
I think it's this fascinating subject, because I think there is a significant gap between perception and reality, which I think is common in the region for so many things. And in product specifically, there is this feeling that we're doing well, but for people that have experienced it in other mature ecosystems, most are not. Yes, at some of these top companies, there is very good product management. And then there's a massive, massive gap, and then there's everyone else. And in Singapore, we saw very, very similar things. And the reason I bring up Singapore is because I was 7 years in Singapore, and I saw the evolution in terms of maturity of product management there. And I come here and I see some of the similar patterns. And the thing about product is, people only realize it once they've started making the mistakes that it solves. So when you're building an ecosystem, in Singapore, it started with rocket internet type startups. We take a model that exists elsewhere, and we're going to build it for the local market, right? So it was the Zalora, Zalando type, And so what that means is that the people that were starting those companies, they were marketers. Mm. And tech was kind of an afterthought. They realize that they need developers. So then the ecosystem builds around having software engineers. After a while, you realize that you do need somebody to manage them. Mm-hmm. So you're going to need software engineer managers. And then eventually, you realize that you might need other roles that are more specialized, like data engineering or product managers.
Yeah.
But it takes quite a while before it reaches that point. And then you have a lack of maturity, because there just hasn't been enough years of the system. One of the big problems with product management is it's not obvious from the get-go what are the right decisions.
Yeah.
The only way, the way that product management has evolved is in a place like the Silicon Valley, there are so many people doing the same things, that you can understand what works or what doesn't from a large volume of tries. Mm. Whereas if you go to a place like Singapore and here, when there are just a few successes, what I often see is people assume that whatever they did was the reason for the success. Mm. And so in product management, it becomes very, very dangerous. Very specific example, in Singapore, one of the problems that I was facing was the idea that if you just send more push notifications, you will get better results. Even though we know that if you hammer somebody with push notifications, they will turn them off.
Yeah, I was just going to say, don't annoy the hell, don't annoy the hell out of people either.
But if you look at it from a incremental standpoint, if I send 1,000 more notifications and one person opens it, and 1 out of 10 times they will do something that I want out of that, that's still an incremental benefit for me if I look at it in this very narrow view. And because there isn't that larger number of, you know, tries that helps to say, like, no, this is a stupid idea.
Yeah.
Well, we see people saying, like, oh, that's what we should do. And there's not much that you can say to convince them that they're wrong. Whereas if you take anybody in the Silicon Valley, it's going to be, of course not.
Yeah.
Right. And so this is what I'm seeing here. It's like there is a lack of that. And the fact that people don't see that there is a gap in product management is the biggest challenge.
What do you see the role as a product, maybe more of a chief product officer rather than just a product manager? How do you see that role? Because you're talking there about, okay, understanding market trends, market data, you know, understanding what the industry is doing as a whole, probably understanding, okay, what's the business strategy? You know, what is the ultimate goal rather than just, okay, we need to build this app, let's go build it, or this product, which is very narrow, you know, feature function type approach. But where do you stand with all of that, and does it change between startup and big company?
Do you know what? Can we just clarify one thing that I think will be really, really important, is what's the difference between a product manager and a product owner? I think that, like...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do that first. Put my question for afterwards.
It will lead on to this, definitely. Yeah.
So the product owner is a concept from Agile methodology, and it is not actually a kind of job description, but it is a role. So one of the roles, it could be assigned to anybody. That's what I mean by role. And it is extremely tactical. It's very, very close to the software engineering, and they're looking at the details. Product manager is more strategic. Now, the reality is it's such a broad role that it'll be defined differently in every single organization. I've worked in some organizations where they say there's a technical product manager. Mm. In my mind, they should all be technical. Some say outbound or more focused on,
It depends on the size of the product as well. It does this, yeah. Because sometimes you can't have one product manager.
Might have multiple for different, you know, areas of the product.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, and you might have one for each product as well that you're operating as well, or you might have one for, you know, two or three products, and then one is much bigger, and you have one for that, shall we say? I think that clarity. I think it was more for the viewers than us, shall we say?
It helps me as well. Okay. I don't work in products. So.
cool.
But it's confusing. I mean,
it is.
Yeah. And so getting back to your question about like on the chief product officer, and there's an interesting question as well. It's like, well, don't we have chief technology officers? If we do, then why do we need that? There's also some discussions about having CPTOs or CTPOs and why, and I think if you think about the role of the product manager is to optimize for the success of the product.
Mm.
And it's different from the sales lead. Their role is to optimize selling. That is very short term.
Mm.
They're not looking at 2 years from now. They're looking at how do I sell what I have now?
Yeah, that salesperson wants a CPO to build the roadmap so they can go and sell the roadmap rather than build the roadmap, right?
I think that there's another thing here as well. You know, the CTO, there's a conflict of interest, I think, as well. Because sometimes if the CTO is in charge of the product and managing the product, sometimes there's conflict of interest when it comes to budget, the technology, those kind of things as well. And I feel as though a true product manager, they evolve the product based on, say, the market. You know, a CTO doesn't really look at market research.
So that's why, in my mind,
yeah,
it's great to have both a CPO and a CTO because they serve different roles.
Correct.
And the CTO can focus exclusively on technology.
Yep.
And the CPO can focus more holistically on where are we going with this product. And if one is, you know, the hierarchical superior to another, or they're both shared by a single role, I can't have that push and pull within myself. I mean, I could, and it depends. In some cases, for some organizations, that can work fine because you're going to have a CTO that has a bit of the product, you know, sense and is, you know, it's maybe 70% CTO or 30% CPO, and that can work. But having both is very, very useful. And getting back to your question, to explain like why, well, because the CTO is going to be looking exclusively at technology. The CPO needs to factor in every single aspect of the business as it relates to the success, the long-term success of this product. And this product, here I say product, but in reality, when you're a CPO, you're looking at the product being any single output that the company will produce. It's not necessarily one existing product. It's not necessarily the product that you have today. It could be the services surrounding it. It's the whole output, let's say. And so the key is you need to take into consideration the fact that there are salespeople and they're going to have to sell it. And you need to keep that, you know, chief commercial officer happy. You need to understand them, their considerations, because they're legitimate. You need to understand the technical considerations. You need to understand the CEO's direction that he's setting for the company. Any other considerations, of course, the market, but any other considerations, it might be customer success, it might be, I don't know, HR, whatever is relevant.
Governance,
yeah, a lot of legal. Yeah. Depending on, I did a lot of, at Google in particular, the volumes are so big, so you need legal for everything, privacy, right? And you need to take all of these in. And the point of the product, the CPO, is that they're optimizing for this complex mix. Whereas the other roles, they can more silo themselves into this is what I'm optimizing. Okay. I'm optimizing for just technology. And if you didn't have that, it would always go straight to the CEO.
Yep, correct.
Right?
Yep.
And so the CPO doesn't have the authority of the CEO, but part of the role is to get to alignment between all of these people. And that alignment comes from translating the needs of all of these people into a common language so that everybody can look at a single thing and say, oh, I agree with this statement, right? And so this is what we're all agreeing on across the different functions. That's the hard part.
I think I'm going to share an experience. Yeah. So I recently I worked with a startup. There was a CTO and a CEO. So the CEO had a vision, and he made very clear what that vision was. The CTO took that vision and tried to build it into a product. Along the journey, I would say, the CTO was so focused on building to the exact spec that the CEO had provided. There's no market analysis. There was no like validation of the idea. You know, all those things were missing on the, and like someone like Raphael, he would basically stop it before it goes too far. That's what I'm trying to say. And like the moral of the story is they went too far in the wrong direction before they turned back onto the right direction because of that, like, certain pieces of the jigsaw or certain skill sets missing in the CTO, shall we say.
But I think that's part and parcel of learning as a startup, right? You're never going to have all of the right people with all the skill set, which I think makes part of the sort of the fun and the learnings. Like that CTO, you know, if he ever goes on to do another product, you know, maybe it's like, okay, well, I've learned that not just building and saying yes and creating something is the best route plan.
I think, you know what, more than anything, I think in my mind is, you know, when startups have that lack of experience, reach out. Mm. Reach out and try and find someone to kind of give you, you know, a little bit of a direction as to if you are... Because one of the massive lessons that I learned out of that scenario was that it's better to kind of sidestep and say, right, guys, are we going in the right direction and kind of have a reflection like you were talking about, rather than carrying on down this journey and even getting to, you know, the end of two sprint cycles, shall we say. That reflection is so important. But I'm trying to kind of get at, there's a lot of founders here in Dubai, yeah? In Dubai and the GCC. What I'm trying to kind of get the message across is, don't always think that it's wrong to ask that question, you know, and question early, shall we say. Because it could, number one, it could save you time. Mm. Number two, it could save you a hell of a lot of tokens, yeah, from what I saw, yeah? And a lot of money as well.
One thing I want to jump in there is, I love analogies, so I'm going to use an analogy.
Yeah.
It's very local. If you wanted to build the Burj Khalifa, you're going to look for specialists. Mm. Somehow, people don't think about doing the same thing when they're at a startup. They think, like the simple version that I said, I have an idea, I'm going to get somebody that I'm going to get a builder, and the builder is going to build it. So you're going to get a bricklayer, and you're going to tell them, here's this drawing of the Burj Khalifa, build it for me. And guess what's going to happen? Exactly what you expect, right? It's going to be an absolute mess. Instead of saying, this is what I'm trying to build, what are the things that I need to understand about it in order to even make any inkling of progress? And then you're going to realize just how deep the rabbit hole is. And I don't know all of the specialists, but I'm pretty sure that there is a specialist of every single kind, including simple things like the plumber for the Burj Khalifa is probably a very, very different type of plumber as than the one that we,
the built your villa in Dubai.
Yeah, exactly. Because like at 800 meters high, like how do you deal with water pressure? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so things like that, right? And I give that example because it's so obvious that you wouldn't build the Burj Khalifa without the specialized tools, even though you don't know who the specialists are. And that's my point. Mm. I'm not expecting you to know who the specialists are. I'm expecting you to understand that there is this unknown, and your job as the CEO or CTO is going to be to identify where the areas of risk that I need to go and find help for. And there are plenty of places you could find help. You can find help in books. Mm. You know, for product management, there are a lot of books. They're great books. You can go to advisors. You can go to your VCs, your accelerators, your peers, of course, right? There's so many places you can go.
I think even in this region specifically, there's so many networking events, yep, where you get to meet good, smart people that have done the work.
I think that's the message that I wanted to get across, honestly. And you worded it a lot better than me, but that's the kind of message I wanted to get across.
What made, you've kind of touched on this, but for our audience and anyone looking to get into product leadership, product management, what sort of soft skills, you know, would you look for in a product leader? You know, what would, you know, someone thinking about getting into it?
And transferable skills.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because it looks like a bit project management, relationship management, you know, understanding how to code is probably
pretty... So there are a lot of elements that are helpful. There's a lot of, you know... Essentially, because product management, there was a blog post a very long time ago saying the product manager is the CEO of the product. And sometimes that was misunderstood. But the point there is they're ultimately responsible for the success of the product, which means there is nothing out of scope. That's the key point here. There is nothing out of scope. What that means is that there are a lot of skills that will be required. Sometimes it's going to be understanding legal and privacy stuff. Sometimes it's going to be understanding code, knowing where to push back on engineers because they're giving you a timeline that's just way too long. Often in all of those cases, you'll realize that it's a lack of understanding. There's something that was dropped. It's like, well, wait. You didn't understand that what I was saying is this part, I'm okay with it being throwaway. But we need it quick and dirty. This part, we need to build it for the long term, right? Or actually my legal risk, like, no, you don't understand. This is the part that I think has actual risk. And that's what I'm asking you to, your opinion on as a lawyer, not in general, like on GDPR.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and so all of those things will be helpful. However, the things that come back most often are, it's a relationship job. Because the most important thing is to be able to tease out what each stakeholder cares about and wants and needs. So that, when I say like, and I'll give the example of the roadmap, right? When you have that roadmap that you show to everyone, everybody feels like their input has been heard and they understand why we're doing what we're doing. But it's also true for various different things around like the vision or the longer term plan. And so they need to feel heard. In order to do that, you need to really listen. You need to be able to tease out, like when that CEO says, here's my vision, you need to be able to tease out the part that matters from the part that is just a specific example that they gave to try to make it clear. Right, and they say, I want to build the Burj Khalifa. It's like, wait, okay. You want to build a really, really tall building? You want to build the tallest building in the world? You want to build something that's like, wow? Like, which is it? Which combination is it? So that we can get to the actual core of what you care about. And then you're going to go to engineering. It's like, what's the actual problem that you have with this? Oh, it's impossible to maintain. It creates too much tech debt. It's like, okay, why? Tell me. Let me understand. To the customer, I want this feature. What exactly is it preventing you from doing? Or what's the pain? Or so teasing all of that requires relationship skills. That's the first thing. And then the second big point is, how do you deal with uncertainty to create certainty for everybody else? So, it's the right time, in the region to talk about that, right? Like, uncertainty is everywhere. The point is, and I've actually had to redirect somebody that I worked with as a product manager because product management wasn't for them. Because they couldn't figure a way out of the uncertainty. And you're in a world where you don't know if the customers are going to want it. You don't know if you can build it, how long it's going to take. Should we do it this way? Should we do it that way? You need to convince others, but you're not convinced yourself. Like, there's so much uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And if you drown in that, then you're never going to be a successful product manager. So you need to lead through the uncertainty with confidence that some of the certainty comes through doing. That doesn't mean recklessly saying, hey, my way or the highway, right? But it means understanding that part of it is going to be saying, this is the way that we're doing it, and here are the reasons why. And being, of course, willing to change along the way if necessary. But you need to lead the charge. And that's really, really difficult when you know better than anyone else just how wrong you could be.
I think part of it as well, because we build product ourselves. So we're in the process of building a product. I think a lot goes into it, and the team feel like, hey, we're doing so much, but and hearing back, okay, look, this is what the customers are saying, and feeding that back to the team as well to keep everyone motivated, I think super important. So then you get drowned in, sprint cycles and feature requests and, us as business leaders saying, we want to add this, we want to do this. But then taking a step back and say, look, this is what we've delivered. This is the impact. This is the revenue that we've generated. This is the customer feedback. So, we have actually done quite a lot when it feels like we actually haven't. I think that's what we found building our product is just feeding those small incremental wins back to the team to say, look, we are, okay, we're not like this, but we are going in an upward trajectory.
Yeah.
timing-wise, we haven't got too much time, but I want to touch on how AI is going to change the product, product teams as a whole. Mm. We work in data. We're already seeing it, with technology and vendors coming out. Okay, are they going to replace data engineers? Because you can basically vibe code the entire data pipeline and build dashboards and do all that. How do you see it from a product standpoint and a product team when you're looking at, the future?
There's only so much that, we can confidently say about the future. However, we can start to see the direction that things are changing. Like, I wouldn't say, hey, 3 years from now, this is what it's going to look like, because anybody that says that, in my mind, is,
changes week on week. It feels bonkers. Like at the minute.
Yeah. Bonkers. It's complete, nobody knows. However, we can look back at the past and we can understand, what are the elements that are changing and what does that mean? If we break down the types of elements of the work that product does, right? For the product function, so the product managers and all, and everyone in that chain, AI tools has made it much, much easier to do many of the chunks of that work. It's going to be, for example, for discovery, user interviews, etc. And now you can do analysis of your user interview transcripts really easily. You can generate questionnaires. You can even have synthetic audiences to do basically questionnaires, but they're not with real people, right? So there's so much that you can do there, which is great, super helpful. On the execution part in the software engineering space, everything is so much faster, right? And you can even have non-technical teams that are fixing bugs, for example. Yep. Great. Super, and it's just going to keep getting better and better. And then there's now that we've built this, one of the responsibilities in product is it's not enough that we've figured out what to build and that we've got it built, but we need to make sure that it goes out and it sells. Hmm. And there again, there's a lot of support from LLMs in particular to be able to decline a message that you've written in all kinds of different channels and the blog post, et cetera. The problem is that you still need to figure out what that message is. Hmm. You still need to figure out what the direction that you want to go when you're building is. Those are things that today LLMs can't do. Hmm. Now, they're getting better at asking the questions in order to be able to do that. And I think that's going to keep getting better. Hmm. But today, there's still a point where it's you need to decide. There's a part that's sense. There's a part that's choosing, choice. And Amazon does not make the same, or does not make decisions, product decisions, the same way that Apple does or that Google does. Yep. And so some of that, it has nothing to do with whether an AI can do it or not. It has to do with how an organization chooses to make these decisions, right? And for me, that's the kind of slightly more broader sense. If you look at AI, you think that, well, it's getting better all the time. We're going to replace all of these, knowledge workers, white collar workers, et cetera, because essentially I need a marketer. I'll just get the AI and they're equivalent to the best marketer in the world. Well, there is no best marketer in the world because there are going to be lots of different best marketers in the world. And even if you were to think that you are hiring, you hire a great marketer, you are making so many choices through the hiring process that even when they arrive on day one, and if you were to tell them, then you're good at your job, go for it, which is what you would tell the AI, right? Just solve my marketing.
Yeah. Crack on.
Crack on, right? Well, what you don't realize is that before that marketing person starts, you have already made so many choices by hiring them. When did you hire them? What was the job description? Who did you choose? And those are the types of things that we're still going to have to do around what AI, what agent or et cetera. Yeah. Like there, and this is just to do with choices. It's not, it has nothing to do with one is better than the other. It has to do with we are going to choose. And that choice requires a specific thought process, taking into consideration all of these different elements, which are going to be much easier and much faster to do. Mm. So that part, I believe, is still going to stay.
I think there's, it's an interesting place because I've seen so many companies, even some companies I previously worked for, that were on that race. You know, we're going to do all these different jobs and processes with AI. You saw, you know, especially in the tech sector in Silicon Valley, the amount of, you know, layoffs that were happening replaced by AI that are now coming back and rehiring people. And you see customer feedback going, you know, I don't want to, this AI chatbot that I'm now dealing with when there was a person doesn't give me the information, is becoming a very friction, there's a lot of friction between it. Because like you say, it has a skill and it knows some stuff, but not how you operate as a company and your culture and all these different small bits. And, you know, even just the small conversation you have with a human rather than, you know, people understand when they're talking and pick up the phone and it's not a human. It becomes frustrating at times because there's questions you ask that the AI can't answer, you know, and you kind of go in a loop. So you're in, it's in that interesting space now where AI is going to save costs. But at the same point, it's, you know, I think there was probably a bit too quick of a race to go and replace too many jobs with AI at one point.
I think there's a couple of points there that, like, I think are really, really interesting. Is I feel, and Tom touched upon it already as well, I feel as though everyone's on the race for automation, right? Okay. But decision making is not something that we can have confidence in so far, thus far, shall we say. And I think decision making is really hard. It's a really hard one to automate. And I think if you looked at some of the agents that are out there now at the moment, if you ask it to make a decision for you today, as in 10:05 p.m., it will make one decision. If you ask it again to make consider the same, you know, facts and make another decision at 2 a.m. in the morning, it might make a totally different decision. Would you, as a human, make a different decision? Possibly, yes. And I feel like the way we're going at the moment is, it's like as though you, like the AI has to make mistakes in order to also learn from those mistakes in order to go forward, like we as humans do. But those mistakes can be very costly, as some companies, like you referred to, some companies have started to find out. But I feel the space, the space around product, it's so broad. It's hard to automate everything, and I'm sure you feel the same as well. It's extremely hard. Number one, to automate everything. Number two, to give essentially a CPU the power to make a decision based on a number of different things a human might think of, shall we say.
Well, but the risk that I see, and I've seen it also in some people that have, in a way, they've learnt product only from books, and they've taken it as a gospel. They will go through the motions. And this is exactly what you see for AI. It looks, you know, it looks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, and yet it's not a duck, right? Like, but surface level, it feels like they've done the right things, et cetera, but it's not that. And so that's the risk that I see with product. And it's true for a lot of strategy type work. Mm. If you've ever asked any LLM, with however much context you give it, by the way, so even if you're really good at, you know, context engineering, et cetera, strategy is going to be terrible. Right, because it's so nuanced, and we haven't managed yet today, like, of course it's going to get better, to tweak that well enough. The training data isn't there. The reason why software engineering works so well for you know, LLMs is because it's really clear whether it works or it doesn't. Whereas what about strategy? Even 5 years, 10 years down the line, there is still debate on whether it was a good idea or a bad idea. You don't have an A/B test that you can, you know, validate. So that's going to be really, really tough.
I think another aspect that's going to be really interesting is everyone's trying to explore ways in which they can validate. Say if an AI agent makes a decision, whether or not that decision is the right decision. Right, it's like the AI is analyzing the AI. yeah, that outperform the AI. That for me is a really, because I've not seen any posts or any blogs about success stories. I haven't seen some, and you know, please feel free to share if you've seen. I haven't seen a success story so far around that. It's like as though it's a looping circle, yeah, right. It makes a decision, or it wants to make this decision. This decision A, yeah, right. Now another agent takes this decision A and says, these are, I think, the positive positives. These are the negatives. And have you thought about these? And then he asked that question
again. I feel like we're getting into an age where, where AI is just going to be like, yeah, let's fire Tom and Si. We don't need them anymore. We'll just...
We'll do a better job.
Exactly. As we wrap up, more of a, just a bit of a fun question. What are your favorite tools you like to work with as a product manager? AI or non-AI? Are there any go-tos for you?
The whiteboard.
Love that.
Good old so I have a whiteboard next to my desk, and I find it super helpful to be able to visualize. And I've never found, like, you know, these online whiteboards, et cetera. It's just not as tactile flexible enough. And, you know, like, rigid. When you want to explain something, a hierarchy, something. Yeah. And then on the other side, interestingly enough, my good friend Claude, which is like everyone else, like
Claude's everyone's best friend.
Exactly. I have built my own tooling, right? And it's all kind of custom built for me, including a CRM, and it connects with everything I do gets put in there, and then it can be mined, etc. Still just the beginning, but it compounds. That's I think the most important.
And I think you've got to spend time investing in that side of your LLM and your AI tool, is, you know, really giving it context, really building up the knowledge and the skill set for the, for, you know, if you're going in and just asking odd questions without training it and doing all this stuff, you get generic answers, right?
And some of it is for me, part of what has made this a success is that I have built it like it was a journey. It was not, I took something, even if that existed, taking something off the shelf, give it access to everything, right? I actually set up OpenClaw, and then I never used it, in part because my background is security. Yeah. So I set it up as a separate, well, you know, contained VM, basically. And then I realized that it was useless without giving it way more access than I was comfortable in for use cases that I didn't really need, right? However, what I have built for myself is tailored to what I need specifically. I've built my own CRM. It's not Salesforce, but Salesforce would be a nightmare for me to work with for the scale that I'm at and what I need. And because I've built it little by little, it is tailored to what I need. And I still sometimes see some things where I'm like, ooh, that was a good idea. And I kind of like built something at the time, but I haven't used it. And you can see how it's already rotting away, right? And that to me is the biggest signal. It's like this idea that if I haven't built it because I needed it, right, little by little, I realize that it doesn't serve me. It slows me down. It's painful. And that's true for a lot of the kind of off-the-shelf software where there's has like 17,000... you know, or even Notion. I used to use Notion. I don't use Notion anymore because it had so many things that I didn't need, and it was just more complicated.
Fields, and it's like, I want to input this and move to the next thing.
I use Markdown files now. Nothing simpler than that. It's basic, but it works just right for what I need.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Likewise.
How can people get in touch if you're open to connecting with viewers?
Yeah, happy to connect.
LinkedIn, I assume?
LinkedIn. Yeah. LinkedIn's the easiest. You can look me up there. My handle is rperet, or look up my company, Sharp, with a slash in the middle. So SHA-RP, RP, my initials.
What we'll do is we'll add those in the show notes so people can find you and just click it. So what are you doing now then? So you talked about Sharp, just for viewers, you know, so are you kind of offering services now around the product ownership space, product leadership space?
So I advise startups and I do fractional leadership, typically CPO, so fractional CPO. So fractional being when you're at a stage where you need that help, like we were talking about it.
Yep.
Well,
yep.
Maybe at the beginning, you'll need a bit of advisory, a bit of advice, you know, an hour a week, a day a month. And then you might get to a point where you would like to have senior leadership in this function, but it doesn't make sense to hire somebody. And it's a combination of you probably don't have the money to put in there, but also you wouldn't be able to find somebody because they would be so bored in this job that they would leave.
Yeah.
And so this basically solves the problem that the only way to get senior leadership is the step function of zero and then one, when your need is actually probably a lot more linear.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Bro, well, in that case, everyone that's listening and watching down the lens, if you're in need of product advisory, please get in touch with Raphael. I'm sure he'd be more than happy to entertain conversations.
Or just grab coffee, just grab here.
Love a coffee.
For anybody in the UAE. Yeah. It'd be great.
Bro.
Thank you so much, Raphael. It's been a pleasure, honestly.
Thanks,
it's been an enlightening conversation.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
You know, I learned a lot, which is always a good thing. When I leave this chair, it's like, I want to learn something. I've learned something today. Bro, good sigh. Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone.
Should we get a picture?
Yeah, we'll definitely get a picture.
That was a good one, man. Thank you.
Yeah.